With the latest agriculture news from across the state and nation, it's time for the AgNet News Hour from AgNet West. Here's your host, Sabrina Halvorsen.
Good morning, and thank you for joining us this morning on the AgNet News Hour. Coming up later, we hear about a project that seeks to address food safety barriers for organic specialty crops and also concerns over rising farm debt levels. But our top story today, the National Corn Growers and 16 state-affiliated associations joined more than 140 allied national, regional, and state commodity organizations opposing changes to the USDA disaster relief. The groups sent a letter to Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack relaying their concerns with the design of the Emergency Relief Program for 2022. While the group showed appreciation for the allocation of $3.74 billion in much-needed ERP assistance, the groups expressed serious concern with the changes. The biggest change is a progressive factor that reduces the disaster assistance for many eligible growers based on the size of their losses. USDA also changed the method used to incorporate producer-paid insurance premiums. The letter says, quote, "In the case of the progressive payment factor, we oppose a policy that delivers the least amount of benefit to those who have lost the most outside of the payment limits provided in the statute. Support should be equitable for losses of all magnitudes." Secretary Vilsack spoke to farm broadcasters in Kansas City about his vision for the future, specifically as it pertains to value-added agriculture. David Geiger has this report.
Listen, it just seems like I've been with you for the 80 years of this association. But it is good to be back, and I think I've got quite a bit to talk about today.
Secretary of Agriculture Tom Vilsack spoke at the National Association of Farm Broadcasting Convention in Kansas City last week. Something has been on his mind, consolidation. He points to a book from the 1800s in his office, the first report from the Commissioner of Agriculture.
In the preface of that report, he talks about concerns that he has about consolidation of farmland and the impact that it had in history on what he believed to be the rise and the fall of the Roman Empire, and was suggesting that we in the United States need to keep an eye on that very issue.
Fast forward to the 1980s. Vilsack says the Secretary of Agriculture at the time expressed similar concerns as they moved away from contained production to market orientations.
And some of you may remember Secretary Butts, who basically said to American farmers, hey, fence row to fence row, plant whatever you can, produce whatever you can. Bob Berglund expressed similar concerns to what Isaac Newton expressed, which was, is this policy going to lead to larger farms and fewer farmers? And if so, is that a good thing?
After reading those reports nearly 100 years apart, Vilsack says he had some self-reflection.
I asked myself whether or not there has, in fact, been a decline in the number of farms, and if so, how much, and should we be concerned about it? Well, it turns out, since 1981 to the present time, we've lost 437,300 farms. That's one out of every six farms in this country gone. Just to give you a sense of how many farms that is, that's every farmer today in Iowa, Minnesota, Wisconsin, Illinois, South Dakota, Nebraska, and Colorado. Gone. And the first question I think I ask audiences, including this one, is, are we okay with that? The second thing I learned from the ERS report that I looked at was that in addition to losing all those farms, we also lost farmland, about 141.1 million acres of farmland, which was in farming in 1981 that isn't in farming today. Now, to give you a sense of how much land that is, that's the entire states of Florida, Georgia, South Carolina, North Carolina, and Maryland. That wasn't farming, that isn't farming today. Are we okay with that?
Last year was the best farm income in the history of the U.S., yet Vilsack was concerned because half of the farms didn't make money, and 40% of farms that made money still needed an off-farm job to support themselves. So he asked, who got the money?
Well, it turns out that if you have farms that sell more than $500,000 in sales every year, you are one of 150,000 farms in the country. You're 7.5% of all farms. They received 89% of the income. Now, they didn't produce 89% of the products. They produced about 68%. So they got a majority. They got almost 90% of the income, which meant that 92.5% of our farms, roughly 2 million, had to share 11%. So it's really difficult to get big if you're part of that 92.5%, unless there's an alternative.
That alternative Vilsack wants to promote is another option for small and mid-sized farmers. He listened to 89 organizations, including farm, conservation, and environmental groups.
Basically said, we need help to embrace climate smart practices, but in order for it to work, it has to be voluntary, it has to be market oriented, And you have to provide assistance to farmers to basically embrace those climate smart practices. So that's essentially what we set up. We took resources from the Commodity Credit Corporation, as those groups suggested. In fact, we were pretty modest. They suggested we go at $50 billion. We did three. We funded 141 projects, and in those projects, we're now in the process of seeing farmers being paid to embrace climate smart practices. So there's no risk to the farmer. They are essentially going to get resources to be able to embrace if they wish. Voluntary, totally voluntary.
Many projects include an arrangement with a buyer where they pay a premium.
You've got organic, which is high value. You've got commodities, which is low value. You got nothing in between. This is essentially creating, if you will, a third type of commodity, which is value-added.
These value-added projects is a key part of what Vilsack wants to do.
My favorite is the sustainable aviation fuel opportunity. You're not going to be flying in a hydrogen-powered plane for a long, long time. You're going to be flying in a low-carbon fueled plane. And that low-carbon fuel is sustainable aviation fuel, and it is a 36-billion-gallon industry that does not exist for all intents and purposes today.
That's nearly twice the size of the existing biofuel industry. Vilsack says the value-added aspect gives multiple avenues of opportunities for farmers.
It's not in lieu of, it's not in place of, it's in addition to. And it gives every producer small, mid-sized, large opportunities they didn't have before. And we think at the end of the day, that's really important. The future of agriculture.
This is all paid for at the moment for the next 5 years or so, allowing a structure for the next farm bill. Vilsack says what U.S. agriculture needs is a system, one that gives opportunity.
It isn't just about the future of agriculture. It's about the reliability of the food supply. And the reality is, if we have heavy concentration, a disruption within that concentration can cause serious problems with our food supply.
Vilsack says that was seen during the pandemic. And beyond that, fewer farmers hurts rural communities, creating fewer hospitals, schools, and businesses. Additionally, he says, with the disproportionate amount of military volunteers coming from rural areas, it also hurts national defense.
So I think this is a really, really, really important thing. And I think it's important for the country to ask the question whether we're okay with 437,000 fewer farms. Are we okay with 141 million acres lost? Are we okay with that heavy concentration of farm income? Or would we prefer an option?
Again, Secretary of Agriculture Tom Vilsack speaking to a group of farm broadcasters at the NAFB National Convention. I'm David Geiger.
This is the AgNet NewsHour. I'm Sabrina Halverson. We will return in just a moment with more of the day's national headlines and local reports, including our livestock report with Randall Wiseman when we return. You are listening to the AgNet NewsHour. I am Sabrina Halverson. In today's National Spotlight, the storm system around the nation that's winding down today after a cross-country trek expected to bring various benefits of an agricultural type. Here's Rod Bain.
An eastward moving storm system makes its way to the Atlantic coast, expected to wind down by Thanksgiving Day. USDA meteorologist Brad Rippey, however, says despite the slowdown of remaining field work along the system's path, there are agricultural benefits from this system across various parts of the country. First,
this rain is falling in some of the nation's driest areas, including the South and into parts of the Midwest and the Mid-Atlantic, all areas that have had flashy type drought over the last several weeks,
which translates to potentially improved emergence and establishment of winter grains and cover crops. The precipitation could also revive southern pastures experiencing very poor to poor conditions for months.
Hopefully, especially in those southern areas where we still have enough warmth to promote some grass growth, we will get some recovery before we get into the cold season for those drought-ravaged pastures.
I'm Rod Bain reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
The president has continued a long tradition of pardoning a couple of deserving turkeys, Gary Crawford reports.
At the White House this week,
we're excited to have our honored guests with us today, Liberty and Bell. This is their day.
It's their lucky day as these two turkeys escaped the oven by receiving pardons from President Biden. Yes, Liberty and Bell.
These birds have a new appreciation for the word, let freedom ring.
Theories vary on which president began this turkey pardoning thing, but Agriculture Department historian Ann Eflin says we do know this.
In 1947, the National Turkey Federation started presenting a live turkey as well as two dressed turkeys to the president, and that's been an annual event since then.
Harry Truman would have been president then, but many credit Ronald Reagan with officially starting the turkey pardoning tradition, which continues today.
I hereby pardon Liberty and Bell.
Gary Crawford reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture.
Congratulations, birds.
That's today's National Spotlight. Now here's Randall Wiseman with today's Livestock Report.
Well, in today's Livestock News, as we celebrate this Thanksgiving Day, National Turkey Federation wants consumers to know how the American turkey industry plays an essential role in feeding people around the world, creating jobs, and helping to maintain a strong economy. The NTF is made up of hardworking men and women on family farms, in the plant, and everywhere in between. Animal health, packaging, equipment, transportation, and more. They all play a role in the production, processing, and delivery of turkeys each year. But according to USDA Outlook Board Chairman Mark Jekinowski, times are challenging right now for the turkey industry.
Demand has been relatively weak. There's been a lot of pressure on prices. You know, for 2023, we reduced our price forecast this month by 2.5 cents per pound. And for next year, for 2024, year over year, we're anticipating prices to be down about 5 cents per pound, $1.37 per pound. And it's all reflecting relatively weak demand, despite really no production growth either.
Now, for a closer look at how the turkey industry creates jobs, you can go to the National Turkey Federation website, turkeyfeedsamerica.org. In other news, on this Thanksgiving Day, Mark Uppold takes a break to give us a holiday poem that he wrote a few years back.
Happy Thanksgiving from all of us. It's been our tradition to read a poem I wrote many years ago called Thanksgiving on the Farm. The chores are done. It feels like winter. Let's get inside for our Thanksgiving dinner. As I walk toward the house, I pass by the barn. Inside, the cattle and horses are bedded and warm. They had a tough summer with the heat and all. They've been doing a lot better since early this fall. I head to the house to my family and wife. It's been a good year. This is still a good life. As I hang up my coat, I can see on the mirror a picture of Dad and his B. John Deere. I thank the Lord that I'm still young and able, and then join my family at the Thanksgiving table. I'm Mark Oppold on the Southeast AgNet, wishing you and yours a happy Thanksgiving.
Again, that was Mark Oppold. And a quick reminder, registration and housing for the 2024 Cattle Industry Convention and NCBA Trade Show continues. That event will be held January 31st through February 2nd in Orlando, Florida. Attendees can take part in a variety of educational opportunities, including the Cattle Facts Outlook Seminar. They'll also have weather and industry updates, grazing management workshops, guest speakers, and much more. Cattlemen's College is also being reimagined for the 2024 event. To learn more about tickets and how to sign up, simply go to convention.ncba.org. And the American Sheep Industry Association wants to remind producers registration continues for their convention next year. It'll be held at the Sheraton Denver Downtown Hotel. Early bird rates apply through December 8th. All online registrations must be completed, though, by December 18th. To learn more, go to sheepusa.org. I'm Randall Wiseman for AgNet West.
This is the AgNet News Hour. I'm Sabrina Halverson. We will return in just a moment with more agriculture news. Coming up in a few moments, we'll have today's This Land of Ours report, but first, more of the day's agriculture news. And with today's AgNet West headlines, here's Brian German.
In today's Ag Business Update from AgNet West, a project aimed at addressing food safety challenges for organic specialty crop growers has been awarded $3.5 million. The University of Rhode Island will be leading the research project through a grant from the USDA Organic Agriculture Research and Extension Initiative. The project stems from feedback received by the Organic Center regarding difficulties organic farmers face in managing food safety. The study identified issues including compliance costs, water testing, and livestock proximity as significant barriers for organic growers adhering to both national organic program and food safety standards. The grant aims to develop user-friendly risk assessment tools and educational materials to facilitate compliance, including in-person workshops and webinars. The goal is to enable organic farmers to simultaneously meet NOP and food safety regulations, ensuring continued growth in the organic sector without compromising safety standards. There are some concerns regarding debt and the farm economy. Tanner Inkey with Cobank's Knowledge Exchange recently explained the current concerns to the California State Board of Food and Agriculture.
Long term, we're concerned about rising levels of debt, not just globally or in the United States, but also on the farm. Debt levels continue to rise. However, we find solace in the fact that farmers' net worth is also fairly strong. Asset values have been resilient. And so as debt levels go up, they've been accompanied by rising asset values as well. So are we going to see a repeat of the 1980s when you saw that last big spike of debt back in the late 1970s, 1980s? Not likely, because asset values have held in very well, and it's not likely that we're going to see a popping of any bubbles in agricultural real estate like we saw in the 1980s. And indeed, that asset class is quite strong.
The California Waterfowl Association extended the application period until November 30th for the Rice Levy Program. Funded by the California Department of Fish and Wildlife, the initiative provides incentives to rice farmers who manage their internal levies for upland nesting bird species such as mallard and pheasant. To qualify, rice levies must be reconstructed or left from the previous growing season by January 1st and remain undisturbed until July 15th. Farmers willing to forego reworking their rice levies for a year can apply. Applications due November 30th will be ranked, and then successful applicants will be notified by December 8th. Key requirements include allowing monitoring of enrolled levies, documenting nesting activities, and submitting bids as a cost per linear foot. Landowners may receive flexibility if fields are unplanted in the spring. For more information on the program, you can visit calwaterfowl.org. Last month's Consumer Food Insights report from Purdue University's Center for Food Demand Analysis and Sustainability reveals that nearly 4 out of 5 Americans plan to celebrate Thanksgiving with a special meal. The survey, covering 1,200 consumers, assesses food spending, consumer satisfaction, and values, as well as support for agricultural and food policies. Survey data indicated that 79% of respondents intended to partake in a Thanksgiving meal, with 37% hosting, 43% attending, and 5% opting to eat out. Turkey prices are expected to be higher for hosts, but retail prices have decreased 10 to 15% from last year's record highs. Along with turkey, other Thanksgiving staples such as green beans, mashed potatoes, gravy, stuffing, bread rolls, and pie are expected to be a part of a majority of consumers' meals. However, regional variations were also present. I'm Brian German for AgNet West Radio Network.
Thank you, Brian. Many frozen turkeys come with a handy pop-up device that tell you when the turkey is done. But how reliable is that device? Gary Crawford tells us on This Land of Ours.
I love those little pop-up things on the turkeys. I just wish they made a little sound when they pop up, like, turkey's done. But actually, food safety experts say just because the pop-up goes, turkey's done, that turkey may not be up to a bacteria-killing temperature in all parts of it, so pop-ups can be deceiving because...
they're only taking the temperature in one portion of the turkey.
Meredith Carruthers with USDA's Meat and Poultry Hotline says first we really should be using a food thermometer on that big bird.
And we really recommend to check the temperature in 3 places.
Oh, Chicago, Cucamonga, and New York?
No.
Try these places.
The thickest part of the breast, the innermost part of the wing, and the innermost part of the thigh.
They all need to be at least 165 degrees to kill any bacteria. Gary Crawford for the U.S. Department of Agriculture.
This is the AgNet News Hour. I'm Sabrina Halverson. We will return in just a moment with more agriculture news. Welcome back to the AgNet News Hour. I was at the National Association of Farm Broadcasting annual convention this month and caught up with Val Dolcini of Syngenta. Here is our conversation.
My name is Val Dolcini, and I'm the head of sustainability and corporate affairs for Syngenta.
Let's talk about sustainability. That has always been important and something that farmers have always been aware of and doing, but it has become so much more visible. What is Syngenta doing right now to help that sustainability be visible?
You know, Sabrina, we've had sustainability on our radar for a lot of years, and actually Syngenta has been on a sustainability journey beginning with our good growth plan in the early 2010s that made commitments to the number of farmers that we were going to train, the number of acres that we were going to try and conserve through things like our Operation Pollinator, and now we're looking at the sustainability of our own operations. So we're not just talking the talk at Syngenta, I think we're really walking the walk. And what we're doing is emulating the work that farmers have been engaged with for decades now. Farmers are really the original environmental stewards in this country, and the work that they do to ensure a healthy and productive landscape, healthy water, good air, good soil health are all essential pillars to a sustainability program.
So you talk about sustainability and what Syngenta is doing even within its own company. What are some things that Syngenta is looking at within the company for sustainability?
You know, we have substantial production facilities all over the world and certainly here in the United States. And I think that the things that Syngenta has done successfully is really look at its own operations and try and develop ways to become more sustainable, whether it's through the fleet of automobiles that we use around the nation or trying to capture more carbon in some of our greenhouse gas emissions, or even looking at things like putting solar on the roof of our production facilities or creating pollinator habitats in some of our larger campuses. There are lots of things that we can do to really impact the footprint that we have here in the United States. Syngenta is active in about 40 states, and we've got 4,000 or so employees from coast to coast. And those things, I think, really give us added credibility when it comes to talking about sustainability with farmers and ranchers around the country.
Is there anything else that you would like to talk about Syngenta today?
You know, just the work that we do to benefit farmers is critical. I view Syngenta as a real innovation powerhouse, and the research that we're doing in the Midwest around new seed traits and greater yields is vital to making sure that American agriculture remains the thriving industry that it has been for many decades, and that farmers continue to demonstrate the resilience that they've shown, overcoming trade barriers in some cases, bad weather, other issues, lack of labor and other resources that farmers really rely on. Syngenta is there as a partner and always will be.
You've got something exciting that you're doing. Tell me a little bit about it.
Yeah, I was just elected to the board of directors for American Farmland Trust, which is the nation's leading farmland conservation organization. And AFT does a lot of really critical work in states all across the nation to not only conserve farmland, but to develop more sustainable practices for farmers. And really through its research and through the work that it does with nonprofit organizations and academic institutions and farmers on the ground, AFT is viewed as a really reliable and credible partner for farmers who are interested in conserving a resource that is non-renewable, that we can't really create more of. We've got to ensure that the farmland that we have today is productive and it's preserved for all time, and that's what AFT is all about.
You know, so you and I go, I'm going to say way back, probably a decade now, and this has been a focus of yours that whole time, because when we first met, you were in a position with USDA and had a lot of the same priorities, right?
Absolutely. You know, my work with the Farm Service Agency when we first met was really essential, and the good work that USDA does all across the country today is, you know, a carry-on of that really excellent tradition. But even back then, when I was in California, I served on the board of a local land trust in Yolo County that was focused on preserving farmland in that county. That part of the state has a real tradition of conservation and a strong ethic to preserving farmland. So I'd like to think that, you know, it's been a continuing theme throughout my career, is working to support farmers not only in their operational work, but the land that they do that work on. And I've had a great amount of good luck and good fortune in working with people who help tell that story like yourself and many others who are keenly interested in ensuring that farmers are preserved and the land that they work on is healthy and that the practices that they engage in are sustainable. All of those things lead to a better and healthier American agriculture.
So what are some things that you're hoping to accomplish or get done while you're on the board of directors?
Yeah, you know, the AFT opportunity, Sabrina, is a really good one for me because I think it can leverage all of the experiences that I've had professionally and personally, my time at USDA, my time now in private industry with Syngenta, my experience in California at the local level. All of those things, I think, will make me a value-added board member for AFT going forward. And as organizations like that begin to transition and, you know, the generational shift occurs on the ground across the country, I'll be able to work with my colleagues on the AFT board and staff to help make those things a good, positive reality for American farmers.
Thank you so much for your time today, Val.
Absolutely. It's wonderful to see you again.
My name is Andy Folta. I'm the U.S. Product Marketing Manager for Climate Field View with Bayer Crop Science.
Tell me a little bit about your digital solutions for ag.
Right. So Climate Field View is our digital platform, and it's essentially a one-stop shop landing page hub for farmers to be able to collect, visualize, and analyze data so they can bring in any kind of, you know, data layer as they go over their fields. Every time a farmer drives across their acres, they're generating data. A lot of them have been generating and collecting it for years and decades in some cases. FieldView gives them a place to put it so they can visualize it, pull reports, do trial analysis on it, but then also take that data and share it either to a third-party platform to utilize it in, you know, new and exciting ways, or, like we've seen with the majority of our climate FieldView users in the U.S., take it and share it to a trusted advisor, so an agronomist or a dealer, so that they can help them dig out insights on their acres.
So the sharing aspect of this, it seems that that would be very important, because it's one thing to have data. It's another thing to make sure the right people have data.
Right. And like I've said, we've seen the majority of our farmers take that data and they share it because, you know, farming is very hard. It's very taxing on farmers, and they're not making these decisions in a silo. A lot of times they're building a network around them of, you know, farm managers, agronomists, maybe some industry representatives. So we give them the option to take the data at whatever level they want. They can share a single field, specific parts of the data, or their entire operation, and they can share it to that trusted advisor so they can start to, you know, A, dig through the data and discover some insights, but also they can start to build some plans for the, you know, future year. So we have tools and capabilities for farmers and dealers where they can go in and create variable rate planning prescriptions, essentially a crop plan for next year. And then we can execute that in the cab with our connections with Precision Planting, John Deere, and all of our OEM manufacturers, so that as a dealer, I create my plan with a farmer, it syncs over to the piece of equipment, and it gets put into the acres.
So for our listeners who are hearing this and thinking, wow, this would be amazing, what should they do to get more information?
Okay, so I would do one of two things. So we have climate.com, great domain. On there we have all of our information about what the platform is, what it can offer for all of our crops, not just corn and soy, but also cotton, silage, specialty crops, you know, potatoes, tomatoes. I would also look in climate.com at our knowledge center. So support.climate.com walks through everything from creating an account all the way through generating a prescription and executing it. We also have a really dedicated field staff team of climate enablement managers. We've got about 40 across the country. So you can find their contact information, and they're really good at that boots on the ground on farm support.
And don't forget, if you've missed any of our morning shows or just need to catch the news at a different time, you can subscribe to our podcast and have statewide agriculture news at your convenience. All you have to do is search AgNet NewsHour on your favorite podcast downloading app. That's AgNet NewsHour, and it is available on both Apple and Android devices. We will return in just a moment. Welcome back to the AgNet NewsHour. Brian German has today's Almond Update.
Today's segment features a conversation between ABC President and CEO Richard Wacott and ABC Senior Specialist of Industry Communications Taylor Hillman.
Richard, hopefully it's a relaxing weekend for the growers in our industry. They get to spend time with their family and friends for the long Thanksgiving holiday weekend. What are you thankful for? What's something you're thankful for from an industry perspective this year?
Well, I think there are many, many things we're all thinking about as we contemplate this last year and look forward to 2024. Certainly, there are a litany of things that we wish would have improved over the last 12 months. Some of them actually have improved, other things have not. And the experience of the industry has once again been below our expectations and certainly below our potential. I do think that a return to more, I guess, normal weather cycles, we would call it, than we had a few years ago is certainly something to be very thankful for. I think that also the logistical nightmare that we had to live through for a couple of years has abated, and we now, at least when we consummate contracts, we have a pretty good idea of when a container is going to arrive at our customer's loading dock. And the cost of getting it there has certainly also come down on the maritime freight in any way. So I think there are a few things that have corrected, thankfully, in our business and in the world supply chain, but there are a lot of things that haven't. And hopefully 2024 we'll see some further relief on the cost of operations, the cost of growing, and a further increase in demand, certainly. We have seen some pretty good months of shipments this crop year, and so I think we can be thankful for that, that we're seeing not universally, but we're seeing in many markets good demand after the first quarter. And so we've got some other areas that again we're really challenged, and it's not just us. The tree nut complex is in the same situation to a large extent. A lot of other foods are in the same situation to a large extent in terms of the human patterns and habits and consumption, you know, choices that are being made that aren't just bouncing back to sort of pre-COVID years. And so we're studying that very hard, figuring it out. How do we position almonds a little differently within that new environment? And that'll be a lot of the task that the organization will continue to undertake in the coming months and into next year. I do feel I attended the two expos in Turlock and Fresno 2 weeks ago, and I just once again, I can't be more thankful than for the fantastic people that work in this industry, even in very, very difficult times. I do think, unlike a lot of other industries, when times get really tough, and they certainly have been, it can fracture an industry, it can fragment an industry, and everyone goes off in their own direction, and you lose that unity of purpose, you lose the unity of group decision making and smart choices and so on and so forth, and it makes a bad situation worse. I think that what I've seen, what I feel when I talk to people at these meetings, and obviously with our upcoming conference, December 5 through 7 in Sacramento, I'm sure we'll witness the same thing, that this industry it keeps its unity and it keeps its solidarity. And that is so important to being able to tackle what are difficult problems for any industry to overcome. And as I mentioned, some changes in the world as we knew it that are not easily deciphered, and solutions or new approaches to those aren't that easy to develop and implement. So I'm just very, very grateful for the members of our industry, the families that work in this industry, and the unity and solidarity that we have in good times or in bad times.
Yeah, one of the other events you just wrapped up too, that you were able to attend a few of them, was the CEO Almond Gathering kind of roadshow that went on. And again, the same there. How thankful are you for, you know, those meetings could have been a little tough in some situations, but it really wasn't. It was the industry coming together, asking some questions, talking about ideas, and you got to see that firsthand. How thankful are you that the industry really bands together in a time like this?
Yeah, well, I think that was a great example, and I'm glad you brought it up. The listening sessions that we had, all 8 of them in 4 days, up and down 500 miles, basically the Central Valley, were wonderful opportunities for industry members to come and meet Clarice Turner, the incoming CEO, and also to have a discussion with board members, and the board members were different depending on what part of the state you were in. But as you said, I think that the reflection on again our industry is that those that came certainly asked very good questions, difficult questions, made some very sober and yeah, very realistic observations about where growers find themselves economically and the outlook for them and the stress that they're under. So there was no sort of sugarcoating anything that was discussed or any topics that weren't addressed because of maybe being uncomfortable topics. Quite the contrary, it was really embracing everything that was brought up, but at the same time also witnessing the general approach that most of the questions had, which was, what more can we do? What can we work on together to resolve some of the topics that I previously mentioned. And so that's, again, just another hallmark of our industry. I think that we have that quality and that character in our industry that allows us to, you know, meet and discuss and go away and think more and try and then develop and implement new and better ways of moving the industry forward.
Your message for growers over this holiday, I imagine it's pretty similar to the messages we've said the last couple of years. We've been riding this out for a little while where it's been a little rough in the industry. And so relax, take some time, enjoy your family. Is that the message?
Well, I think it is, and always is, and certainly for the Christmas period as well. I really enjoy the Thanksgiving holiday. A lot of cultures have a harvest holiday. Probably most of them do. Certainly the major countries we export do. But the American harvest holiday is special, obviously, and the traditions are special, and the food and the gathering of friends. And then in many families, they invite whoever might not have somewhere to go on Thanksgiving to their home, which I think is a wonderful tradition. So I really love the Thanksgiving holiday because I think it's just so special and American and just so generous, you know, in its nature. So yes, I certainly hope that's how everybody will be able to spend the time on Thursday and over the weekend.
President and CEO of the Almond Board of California, Richard Wacott. Richard, thanks for your time.
Yeah, my pleasure. Thank you. Happy Thanksgiving, everyone.
Thank you once again to Brian German for today's Almond Update. This is the AgNet News Hour. We will return in just a moment. You're listening to the AgNet News Hour, and now for more news. It appears that today, Thanksgiving through the holiday weekend, should be mostly dry weather-wise, conducive to good travel conditions. Rod Bain has more.
The outlook for Thanksgiving Day weekend travel, very good in most parts of the country, according to USDA meteorologist Brad Rippey.
By the time we get to Thanksgiving Day, most of the country is going to be in the clear. So that's good news for travelers, whether you're going a short distance or traveling a great distance or flying. Most of the major airports should be unaffected by significant weather as we head toward and into Thanksgiving once we get this rain in the eastern U.S. out of the way.
Also of note, there is very little snow on the weather map.
Anybody traveling, they would tell you much rather travel in rain than snow. We're not seeing any real wintry weather disruptions at this point in time, and that should last except for perhaps a few areas downwind of the Great Lakes as this system pulls away. We could see some snow showers and squalls downwind of our Great Lakes region.
Dry conditions are expected on Thanksgiving Day for most of the country. The exception is the northern and central Rockies. I'm Rod Bain reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
Well, if you need last-minute answers about preparing that Thanksgiving meal, you'll be able to reach a live expert, even on Thanksgiving Day. Here's Gary Crawford.
While most of us will spend this Thanksgiving relaxing, having some food and watching some football, the folks at the Agriculture Department's Meat and Poultry Hotline, the number of which we'll give you in a minute, will be hard at work. Yes, answering questions from sometimes desperate holiday meal preparers.
Yep, we are getting ourselves ready to answer calls rapid fire.
Oh, and they will be coming rapid fire.
Thanksgiving kind of is a high pressure holiday a lot of times.
So the hotline team will be on duty to help people.
We are open on Thanksgiving Day. This year we'll be open for phone calls and chats. We're open from 8 a.m. to 2 p.m. Eastern time.
So if you have questions Thanksgiving Day about safely preparing that meal, call this number, 1-888-MP-HOTLINE, 1-888-MP-HOTLINE. For live chat, go online to ask.usda.gov. That's ask.usda.gov and have a safe Thanksgiving. Gary Crawford for the U.S. Department of Agriculture.
That's today's top agriculture news. I'm Sabrina Halverson. From all of us here at the AgNet News Hour, have a happy Thanksgiving and thank you for sharing your morning with us. We're thankful for that.
To get more information on the topics you heard today, visit AgNet West online at agnetwest.com. You can also stay connected by following us on our social media at AgNet West on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. You can also find our broadcast team of Danielle Leal, Brian German, and Sabrina Halvertson on Facebook and Twitter. Thank you for listening to the AgNet News Hour from AgNet West. AgNet West Radio Network, your primary choice for agriculture news.